From the Atlantic to the Pacific, across the islands of the Caribbean, from mountain crest to mountain crest, from canyons to the clouds and into the cosmos, we're pumping wattage high and low, plus streaming worldwide on the internet and keeping you company tonight. It's a place to relax and hang out. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, and this is Speaking of Strange, giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest. Well, we've assembled the finest team of reporters and the most intriguing guests, and that's why we are your favorite hub in a wild world. So keep it tuned right here. And as promised, I'm going to do my best to recap some of the most interesting things that I experienced on my latest journey, my epic journey across the continent of North America.
Who are you, Siddhartha?
Yeah, well, I'm more like Robert Ripley.
Okay.
More of a Ripley-esque tale. I kind of wish that I did have a camera following me around to some of these places. It'd be a heck of a show.
Why don't you have a GoPro? These things are well within your reach. You could have walked around with a GoPro on the entire time.
Well, you know what's funny is that, honestly, Sam, I have kind of, I don't want to call it a phobia, but I just don't like being on camera. And I know that's a weird thing for a guy who's been on a bunch of TV shows to say. But I don't want to do the Truman Show or Ed TV or whatever. I just don't like the idea of a camera following me around. And yet, sadly, after things are over with, I kind of wish that I did have a camera. So, anywho, I told everybody last hour, and for those of you just now tuning in, I went from Puerto Rico to New Orleans, spent some time there, then to Los Angeles, spent some time there. Took the Conspira Sea Cruise down the Mexican Riviera to Cabo San Lucas and Mazatlan and Puerto Vallarta for 7 days. Then went back to Los Angeles, met with some TV and movie producers there, had some productive meetings and met with some great old friends. And then went to Dallas, Fort Worth area, spent some time there, spent the night on Jim Marr's ranch. Jim's been a great friend for a long time. This is the first time I'd ever spent an evening with him, and I'm going to tell you about some really cool stuff that happened there. And then finally went to Fort Lauderdale, Florida. That was right around when the Super Bowl was happening, and got to go to a little Super Bowl party there. The Panthers are just never going to pull it off, it doesn't look like. But anyway, and then back to Puerto Rico. So I've just been all over the place. And you know, now, Sam, you say that you are a student of the JFK assassination, right?
I like to consider myself a buff.
Okay. Don't feel pressured or anything, but let me just toss a name out there, and you tell me if this name means anything to you. Guy Bannister.
Yes, Guy Bannister, played by – sorry, I'm eating over here. He was played by Brian Doyle Murray in Oliver Stone's JFK, was he not?
No, Ed Asner played him.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And so him and Jack Lemmon had that scene where he got pistol whipped. Yeah.
You got it. Mm-hmm. Boom. Okay. I knew you were a real JFK aficionado. So when I was in New Orleans, just, because we're going to get back to the JFK thing a little later, but when I was in New Orleans, I did make a stop. I was in a taxi, and I said, I want to do something that is kind of weird. I want to go to this address.
Did you go to the address, the one that's got the two doors on the two different streets?
Yes.
Cool.
Sam, I love you, brother. No, understand it, okay? Because, Guy Bannister was this, like, shady ex-FBI guy who was working as a private investigator in New Orleans prior to the assassination, and he apparently had ties with all of these sort of, like, anti-Castro revolutionaries and was helping to smuggle weapons to the CIA paramilitary groups that were involved in the Bay of Pigs and all that. And Oswald at that time was
fair play for Cuba. Fair play for Cuba Committee.
Yeah. I think he was pretending that he was pro Castro.
A communist sympathizer.
Time. Exactly.
He was a Marxist Leninist.
He was an agent and he was handing out these flyers that had like 541 Camp Street or something like that is the address. But then they realized later on 541 Camp Street is just the other side of the building from like 544 Lafayette Street, which is where Guy Bannister's office was. So basically the two were the same building, and Oswald and Guy Bannister were working together. I know that people are like, whoa, their eyes are glazing over. If you're not into JFK stuff, that won't mean much to you. But if you are, I did go to the place.
I have seen the movie, no lie. I am not exaggerating whatsoever. I have probably seen JFK in its entirety over 40 times.
Good for you.
I love it.
It's an awesome movie. It's a masterpiece.
I love it when Tommy Lee Jones goes, what does he say? I need to cook some eggs, some etouffee.
Yes, an etouffee.
Right.
I love that.
Clay Bertrand.
So I wanted to go to that site. Now, that building is no longer there, nor is the Katzenjammer Bar, which is the place where Guy Bannister and the other dude were getting liquored up before right. Guy Bannister pistol whipped him. But anyway, now if you go to that site where that building was, there is an office building there. I think I'll post a picture of this somewhere for everybody on Facebook or Twitter or something. And it's just like a big office complex. And when you look in the front door, there is like a little snack bar, you know, downstairs. And it's just so weird to think that those people going in and out of that building have no idea that probably a lot of the JFK assassination conspiracy was cooked up, you know, at that spot in New Orleans, that which then, of course, transferred on to Dallas to commit the act. But anyway, so I did that. I went to that site. But let me jump ahead a little bit to the conspiracy cruise. Now, here's something that you probably didn't realize. When I've been promoting this cruise for months, and I met some just fantastic people, listeners of Speaking of Strange, big fans of our work and what we do, who came on the cruise. We had an awesome time. Missy and Ron Hill were there. It was fantastic. But you may not realize that the cruise that we took, it was a Princess luxury cruise, and it went down the Mexican Riviera, and it was actually the same cruise that people would take on the Love Boat show.
Okay. The Love Boat!
Yeah. They would get on a Princess ship, and they would go down, they'd leave from Los Angeles, and they would go down to the Mexican Riviera, and you would always hear about those same locations, Cabo San Lucas and all. So I was
five bonus points. What was the captain's name?
Captain Stubing.
That's correct.
So I am literally on the Love Boat cruise, and I sat down one night in this cigar lounge, and I look over, and the cruise director is sitting there, and he's by himself smoking a cigar, and I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Because the cruise director, I mean, this is the guy who's providing all the entertainment and organization.
Would that
for
have
like
been
four, five...
Isaac? No, Isaac would have been the bartender. Who would have been the analog for that on the show?
The Julie? Girl. Julie. Julie was, I believe, the cruise director on the Love Boat, yeah. And so I start talking to him. He's a British guy, just super nice. Really intelligent. You actually see him on your little cabin TV every day because he has a little show he does every day. So he's kind of like a celebrity on the ship. And so I'm sitting there, and of course I was like, oh my God, I'm buying a bottle of wine. I'm going to sit here and drink with the cruise director of the Love Boat, and I'm going to get some juice. So I said to him, okay, how long have you been doing this job? And he said he'd been doing it like 40 years, you know. A very, very talented man, by the way. He did a rendition of It's Not Unusual by Tom Jones that knocked my socks.
And you wept.
Yeah.
I wept.
I cried like a child. Yeah, it was amazing. This guy's talent is he's got charisma just like radiating.
Oozing.
He's
charisma.
Like the sun. Yeah. So I'm sitting next to him. And his
you totally have a bromance with this guy.
I'm thinking bromance.
Yeah. We had a twinkle in each other's eyes, I think. It's the Love Boat. They design it so that happens to you. So I said to him, you are the cruise director on the freaking Love Boat, man.
Of course you said that.
I said, I know. There are women who come on this cruise, and they are like, I have paid $5,000. I'm having a good time, if you know what I mean. I'm going to come back from this cruise with some stories. And they get
and
to
some
meet...
diseases.
Yeah. Right. And they get to meet you, the cruise director of the Love Boat. Tell me about, like, some of these things that have happened to you with these women. And he just chuckles and he goes, oh, yeah, there have been a few, but I won't go into that, you know. And it's just like, ah, oh, tell me.
Ever the gentleman.
Yeah, he was so British, this guy. So, but here's the thing. The next night, I'm sitting in that same cigar lounge. And there's a man. I swear this is true. I'm not making this up. There was a man who came and he sat down next to our little group. And we're all drinking and having cigars and whatnot. And he starts talking about, you know, how he and his wife do this cruise like once a year and everything. And if there are kids around, this might be a little bit inappropriate. Okay, I'm going to warn everybody. But he said, well, just out of the blue, this guy says, I like to see other men with my wife.
Oh.
Alrighty then.
Yeah. Hello.
He just announces this to your group.
And we're all, what?
Well,
yeah. Two, yeah,
sometimes
just, like,
the best would just throw it out there.
He did. Boy, he tossed it right out. And so, of course, the ladies who were present were like, what? You know, and they start, and he's like, oh, yeah, yeah. And suddenly it starts to set in, and I start to realize, I start to understand, and I feel like such an idiot. It's like, duh, the Love Boat. It's the tugboat, man. You see what I mean? That's what it means.
And the next thing you know, you're in a video where the husband's in the closet and he's watching and he's humiliated.
Yes. Yeah, precisely.
So how was the experience that you go through with it?
The love boat is code name. All these people get together. And they're doing things. There's like a whole other
world. What did Lauren
world.
Warren think about this?
She wasn't there. She was seasick in the cabin at this point. after like the light bulb went off, and I was like, oh my God, all these like older people are coming on this thing, and that's what's happening here. Then suddenly it became so obvious. You'd walk off of the ship to port, and there's like a gigantic, like, Viagra mascot dude standing there giving you the thumbs
up.
You
could have you bought me a voodoo doll. You could have bought me some off-brand Viagra.
Ew. Just ew.
Okay. we're gonna take a break. When we come back, I am going to tell you about one of the most amazing things that I've ever seen in my life, and I'm not exaggerating.
If it's the cruise director again.
I don't know if I can take much more.
I saw it in Mexico, and I'm going to tell you all when we come back. I'm Joshua P. Warren. You're listening to the show where the unusual becomes usual, brought to you by Wright's Coin Shop. This is Speaking of Strange.
A cold steel rail, a smile from a veil. Do you think you can tell?
Lindo vienen bajando un par de ojitos negros, cielito lindo de contrabando. Ay, 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 canta y no llores, porque cantando se alegran, cielito lindo, los corazones. Ventanas a la calle son peligrosas, pa' las madres que tienen, cielito lindo, hijas hermosas. Ay, 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 y las prefiere, porque todo el que pasa, cielito lindo, besarlas quiere.
Yes, you're listening to Speaking of Strange. And I was recently in the Mexican Riviera. That's right. I'm Joshua P. Warren. Tonight's show is brought to you by Wright's Coin Shop. Number to Wright's, 828-298-5402, 828-298-5402. If you go to speakingofstrange.com, you'll find a link to Rites, and I hope that you will go to my personal website, joshuapwarren.com, and just take a look at the Gallery of the Strange. Okay, these are some of the most amazing pictures and videos I have personally hand-selected and put together of ghosts, UFOs, cryptids, psychic phenomena, all kinds of good stuff. If you go to, again, joshuapwarren.com, there is no period after the P. It's kind of funny. Somebody recently posted on an internet discussion board, why doesn't Joshua P. Warren use a period after the P? Well, I actually do, but not in the website address. Okay, so go there and you'll see the goodies I have in store for you. So back to the story. I said that I saw something absolutely amazing in Mexico, and you know, I got to be honest with you, there was a lot about this particular cruise that was kind of unpleasant.
were there donkeys involved?
So the British cruise director. This was, I think, the seventh cruise that I've been on. And when we were coming back, the sea was so rough. Lauren and I had a nice balcony cabin, but it was on the 15th floor, which was the highest floor. And it was at the absolute extreme front of the ship, right over top of the bridge.
The bow.
And so whenever we encountered rough water, and this basically the whole time, especially the last few days, was rough, you'd be in your bed and it would feel like you go up like you're on a swing set, and then it would shudder on the way down. And then it would go up like you're on a swing set, and then I've never suffered from seasickness, but even I was feeling like not so great after 3 days of this. And Lauren, she even wears a seasickness patch, and she was sick the last two or three days. So the ocean was pretty rough. But one of the things that stood out as an amazing memory, we went to Puerto Vallarta, and we're walking down this sort of scenic area next to the coast. And I see a small group of people gathered around, and they're like big pelicans everywhere, and it was really pretty, you know. And I walk up, and I'm like, what are these people looking at? And I look up, and there in front of me is a pole. Now, this pole is about as big around as maybe like a big wide flagpole or something like that. And it's 100 feet tall. Okay. At the very tippy top of this pole, there are five men sitting there. And they're dressed, they're like harnessed to the top of the pole. And one of the guys is actually on the top of the center of the pole. And the other four guys are kind of around the side of the pole. And the guy at the very top is sitting there playing a flute. And they're dressed in this kind of South American traditional garb. And you can hear the high-pitched notes of the flute up there. And I'm looking up and I'm just thinking, well, this is amazing as is, that there are five men sitting 100 feet on top of this pole, and one of them just playing a flute. But then... the four guys around the side each lean backward and they start dangling by 1 foot from the top of the pole.
Dangling poles?
Each one has a rope tied, I think it was to his right foot. And they're dangling upside down at the top of this pole, and now they start to spin. And so you have this dude sitting on top of this pole playing a flute. You have these four dudes spinning upside down around the side. And slowly, slowly, the rope gets longer and longer. And these dudes start descending. And as they actually come down, it took them like 10 minutes, you know, to descend. And so these dudes are swinging upside down from 1 foot around this 100-foot pole all the way from the top till they get to the ground. It was absolutely incredible. It turns out they call this the Danza de los Voladores, which means the Dance of the Flyers. It's an ancient tradition, like an ancient Mesoamerican ceremony, and they originally did this to try to appeal to the gods and end drought, and now it's so rare, there are only just a few little spots around Central and South America that even do it, and of course Mexico only has two or three spots to do it, and it was just absolutely amazing. When the guys actually descended and they got down on the ground, well then, you know, they were taking tips, and I was more than happy to give a tip, but I even went so far as to purchase a flute from one of the guys.
Oh my gosh, you're a flautist now.
I have I've been a flautist for a while. Years ago, I learned how to play sort of a skin flute with my hands. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Where you put your hands in a certain, yeah. But then I decided to move up, and so I have a couple Native American
went
flutes.
Went to a piccolo, then a fife.
So that was incredible. Another thing that stood out in my mind was we went into this church there. Obviously, a lot of these significant towns have really big Catholic churches. And we went into this area where there was a glass case. And if you look into the glass case, there is a very realistic statue of Jesus lying in this glass case. And Jesus was absolutely just covered with, like, dollar bills. Because there's like a slit, and people put money all over Jesus' body. And I thought, I don't think Jesus would like this. You know what I mean? I mean, it's that part of the Bible where he goes, and the one time Jesus turns into an ass beater when he goes into the temple and he starts turning over tables.
The money changers.
Yeah, because they're changing money. And now here's this statue of Jesus lying there, just covered with dollar bills and pesos and everything. That was weird to me. I've never seen that before. Never seen a statue of Jesus, like, rolling around like Indecent Proposal. You know, it's like Uncle Scrooge wallowing in the money. That was weird. And now I'm looking here at my next place we went to was Mazatlan. Mazatlan is a place where they really enjoy passing around a large jar of tequila with a complete snake coiled up inside of it. And people are drinking shots of tequila from the snake jar.
Meanwhile, and they're just laughing at you. Like, the people are like, no, this is an ancient tradition.
Yeah.
Drink the liquor with the snake in it.
So let me ask you guys, if you're in Mexico, you think, oh, well, you know, I'm here to do exotic things. I want stories to tell when I come back home. And they're passing around a giant jar of tequila with a complete, like, filthy old snake coiled up in the bottom of that jar. Would you take a shot of that? Sam, would you?
I'm an alcoholic, so no. But just for the sake of the story and to be hard, I would Chuck Norris it. And I would, like, reach in and just pull the snake out and just bite its head off and be like, bah! And then, like, spit it. But I couldn't drink because, you know, I haven't had a drink in, like, 13 years. So, no.
Okay, well, Shelley, I know that you're into tequila because you appreciate a good margarita, as do I. Would you have taken a swig from the jar with the snake in it?
No.
Well, you know, over the years, I've eaten a lot of nasty things.
Yes, you have.
But even I was like, nope, not going to do this. There were other people there who were like, oh, come on, you know, don't be a wuss. And I just thought, I don't know if I'm just I'm getting older or what, but I just don't feel any value in taking a shot at this nasty snake tequila.
Wussy.
Yeah, so I didn't do it. But I will tell you this. When you go to Mexico, they have delicious food being prepared everywhere. And yet, you know that you're taking a big risk if you eat any of it. And you can't even drink mixed drinks if you want to be sure that you don't get sick because the water can be contaminated. So every time I would go to these Mexican cities, I would just drink nothing but tequila and beer, bottled beer. And so you never, I didn't eat anything, and I'm just drinking tequila and beer. I'm getting trashed every day in Mexico.
You know, you eat the stuff, you build up a tolerance.
Yeah, know. Well, yeah, well, I don't want to. I didn't have time to build up a tolerance. We're up on a break. When we come back, gosh, amazing how time flies. I will tell you about dolphins and sea lions and all kinds of cool stuff. I'm Joshua P. Warren. It's Speaking of Strange. Presented by Wright's Coin Shop. There's never been a better time to visit Wright's Coin Shop than right now, I promise you that. The prices of gold and silver are just going to go up and up and up and up. And so you better get there very soon, and you better get some gold and silver in your pocket so you can take advantage of this. Don't wait till it's at an all-time high. Call Wright's Coin Shop at 828-298-5402. I'm going to say that again in a minute for you, but also remember, if you go to WrightsCoinShop.com, you can get all the info there. There's a link at SpeakingOfStrange.com, and again, that number, 828-298-5402. I'm talking about the trip that I just took across North America and back, and you know, when I was in Cabo San Lucas, beautiful place, I visited Cabo Wabo Bar, Sammy Hagar's place. That's some good tequila.
Went to Bubba Gump Shrimp Company. Went to the Hard Rock Cafe.
No. This is the Cabo Wabo Bar.
Cantina.
Okay? The
Cantina.
And then we went to a dolphin experience. We saw sea lions. We did all that kind of stuff. And you know what? People are always asking me for advice on how to win in the casino, because I usually do quite well in the casino. For the very first time ever, when we got back on the ship, I was actually filmed winning in the casino. Usually you can't film in a casino for obvious reasons. They're very particular about cameras in casinos. But and even in the casino on the ship, you're not supposed to film, but this production crew was there. And they just, like, we were off to the side, and they said, okay, use your method, use the force, let's see you win. And I go, all right, check this out. And boom, I won right there on camera. That was pretty cool. Okay, as I go down my notes, I just want to mention here briefly, really enjoyed meeting Dave and Debbie, who are a couple of fans of the show. They've been to the Asheville Mystery Museum. They've been to Brown Mountain. Had dinner with them a couple nights. Great to see them. I just really enjoyed meeting everybody on the cruise. And I had dinner one night with Nick Begich, and his lady Anne. Boy, they're a fun couple. As a matter of fact, Nick Begich is interesting for a lot of reasons. He wrote a book about HAARP. And his father, also named Nick Begich, was a U.S. congressman who was fighting for the rights of Native Americans to keep their mineral rights in Alaska in the 1970s, and he disappeared in 1972. One of those conspiracies, which is fitting because we're going to talk about some conspiracy stuff. So anyway, at the end of the cruise, like I said, seriously, when the cruise ended, one of the speakers was arrested by federal agents. That's no BS. I won't name any names, but you can look that up on your own. So, hey, I guess that's a sign, like, there's some serious content being discussed on these cruises. So, anyway, when we went to Dallas after that, you know, I had a great opportunity to spend the night with my friend Jim Mars and his wife, Carol. Carol and her daughter, by the way, extremely talented artist. And they've got a really nice ranch there outside of Dallas. But, you know, Jim Mars, if you maybe you know the name and you just can't place it, Jim Mars wrote the book Crossfire. And it was called Crossfire, The Plot That Killed Kennedy. It came out, I guess, in the 80s. And Oliver Stone took Jim's book and an autobiography by Jim Garrison. And he adapted those into the movie JFK. So when you watch the movie JFK, it says right there at the beginning, based on Crossfire by Jim Mars, and I think On the Trail of the Assassins by Jim Garrison. And Jim has written about all kinds of stuff. I mean, you know, UFOs and you name it. But he's obviously best known for his Kennedy stuff because he was born in Dallas. He was a journalism student there. He knew Jack Ruby. I mean, Jim knows more than anybody about the Kennedy assassination. You can bring up names of people that are associated with conspiracies. Well, Jim has actually talked to those people. He's actually sat down and met them and talked to them and has the real story. As a matter of fact, there was an updated edition of Crossfire that came out recently, and I highly recommend you get it. I own a copy, and I love it. It's mesmerizing. So anyway, I'd been to Dealey Plaza before. Dealey Plaza, of course, is the little square there in Dallas where Kennedy was shot. And I just want to point out a couple things. Before, when I went to Dealey Plaza, I did not get a chance to go up into the museum, which actually is the old book depository building where they say that Oswald shot him from. This time I did. And I want you to imagine something. When you go up into that book depository building on the sixth floor and you go over to that corner window where they say Oswald shot John F. Kennedy and you look out that window, you're looking straight down Houston Street. Now, when John F. Kennedy's parade or whatever rolled in, they came down Houston Street. So there was a good period of time when John F. Kennedy was in his car directly in front of that window, driving down the street straight toward Oswald. In that corner window, supposedly. And so if you were sitting there in that corner window and you were looking down Houston Street, Kennedy would be driving straight towards you and he would be getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, right? And then he makes a turn. If you're in the building, it'd be to your right. The car made a turn to the right. At that point, Kennedy, he's right there. He's right there in front of the window, okay? And then he continues off to your right, and he gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until finally, when he's almost out of the plaza, boom, you shoot him then. And there was also heavy foliage and everything. if you're sitting there and you want to shoot the president and you are looking out that window, the time to shoot him would be when he's coming straight toward you down Houston Street and your target's getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, or maybe when he makes that turn, when he turns that corner, then he's right there. That's when you would shoot him. The only reason you would wait, if you were in that position, until he turned that corner and gets smaller and smaller and smaller and farther away, is to wait until he got by the grassy knoll. Because then you could get a crossfire, which is where the name of the book comes from. Meaning that you could be shooting from your point of view, and there could be another person shooting from the grassy knoll, and there may even be another person shooting from somewhere else.
The triangulation of fire.
Exactly. Because if you're a lone gunman, and you have, and obviously Oswald was a very calm, collected individual, the only reason that he would not have shot him when he was coming toward him was because there was a coordination, as you said, Sam, a triangulation between these other points. When I went to Jim Marr's house, and boy, what a fun time that was. Jim Marr's actually has got one of the exact rifles, a Mannlicher Carcano rifle, piece of junk, Italian piece of junk, everybody says. And you always see these people on TV, and they're trying to shoot like 3 shots in 6 seconds. And they're fumbling around, and they can never do it. And you're always thinking, like, are they just playing this up for TV or what? So I got to actually try this out. Now, granted, there was not a live round in it, but it doesn't matter because, you know, I did this over and over. Jim would say, okay, pick up the rifle and go. Now, your first shot is a free shot, right? Because you've already got it's a bolt action rifle. You've already got you've already got it cocked. It's in the chamber. And so, boom, you get one right off the bat. He also had a scope on it that was just like the scope that Oswald had on that, supposedly. And I'm here to tell you, my friends, that when you see people like Jesse Ventura, who is an ex-Navy SEAL, say, this is BS, this cannot be done, it's not an exaggeration. That gun is so jammy, and as fast as you can pull that bolt back and to reset the target in the scope, it takes you a second or two just to do that. And I tried it over and over again, and Lauren tried it over and over again, and I think everybody who has any interest in this subject whatsoever should have the opportunity to pick up one of those Mannlicher Carcanos, just like Jim has, and you try doing that. I mean, it's just absurd to say that a lone gunman did that, okay? Okay, gosh, time's flying on me. We got to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to tell you about a new exhibit that's coming to the Asheville Mystery Museum, and I want to tell you about a UFO crash site that I investigated, one of the oldest in the United States, a crash that happened in 1897. It's a good story. I'm Joshua P. Warren. You're listening to Speaking of Strange.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're in the final minutes of hour number two on tonight's Speaking of Strange. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren. The program is brought to you by Wright's Coin Shop in Asheville, North Carolina. And coming up next hour, well, we call it the Dark 30 Hour. So I'm going to go ahead and give you your first warning. The Dark 30 Hour is all about content we save for late at night because it's not suitable for kids. It's not suitable for the easily offended, okay? It's some of the more outrageous and controversial and sordid and seedy news stories that we have. So you may or may not want to stick around for that. But, you know, if that's your cup of tea, well, then fine, because we're gonna dig into it next hour. But right now I'm finishing up telling you, gosh, it's amazing the highlights I'm having to hit because so much stuff has happened on this journey over the past month as I traveled across North America and back. But, when I was in Texas, it turns out, just amazingly enough, that Jim Mars actually – by the way, before I get into this, let me just mention that, you know, I have the Asheville Mystery Museum, and every year I add new displays to the museum. Well, guess what? I've got two new really cool exhibits that are going to open up this year at the Asheville Mystery Museum. One of them I won't tell you about. The other one I will tell you. Every time you see Jim Mars on TV, he's wearing a fedora. And maybe you haven't put two and two together as you've heard me talk about him. He's got a fedora. He's got a white beard. Well, he's famous for his fedoras. And so when I was there at his home, he actually took one of his fedoras and signed it. And we took a picture of him signing it. It is the fedora that he was wearing when he explored the pyramid at Chichen Itza in the Yucatan Peninsula. And we are actually going to have his signed fedora in a display case in the museum. So that's pretty darn cool. But Jim lives like 5 minutes from this little town called Aurora, Texas. And by little, I mean it's barely a town and so small. And Aurora, Texas has become famous because it's the site of a UFO crash. In April of 1897, all these newspaper reports started coming out of Aurora about a cigar-shaped craft that plummeted from the sky and crashed into, I believe it was a windmill, on this piece of property. And all the residents, of course, were, you know, dumbstruck, and they came around to see what had happened, and there was a little man inside. They described him as not of this world, and they also called him a Martian. And everybody was really, you know, shocked and saddened, and so they took him and they gave him a proper Christian burial in the Aurora Cemetery. And they took all this debris and they dumped it down a well. Well, over the years, a lot of people have been interested in, you know, finding this body. And if you go to the Aurora Cemetery, as I did with Jim and Lauren, sure enough, there is a headstone there. It's weird because it doesn't have any marking on it. Over the years, the headstone has been stolen. But the original headstone just had a drawing pretty much of a saucer-type, cigar-type shape on it. And Jim, who has been studying this for most of his life, he believes that the body was actually taken by the U.S. government years ago, probably in the 1940s. As a matter of fact, he has a document that he showed me where an investigation was put into place saying we need to collect all evidence of, you know, extraterrestrial impact on Earth going back to at least 1897. So they picked that date out just because of this. So I doubt the body is still there, but we went to the cemetery and it was just like, it was chilling to stand there in this peaceful, like green, beautiful little cemetery. Nobody else was around. And to think that in 1897, all of these Texans gathered around and buried a little man there that they believed was from another world. And then we went to the crash site. It's a piece of property that's now just an abandoned house. Or there's an abandoned house there. Jim said that when he first went to that property, he was able to collect all these little like BBs of melted aluminum and sent some of these off to be tested. And the test results came back saying that it was of a formulation that did not exist at the time of the crash. And, gosh, it's just, like, so amazing. I collected some samples from that property, and you better believe they're going to be tested at my laboratory in Asheville. Unfortunately, the clock has got us. We have to take our next break. When we come back, it will be time for the Dark 30 Hour, but I'm glad I was able to give all of you a bit of an overview of what I've been up to over the past month. And now when we come back, we're going to dig into, well, the darker side of things. I'm Joshua P. Warren. It's a show where the unusual becomes usual. It's called Speaking of Strange.